This is Fresh Air. For this Memorial Day, our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has decided to put the spotlight on a letter instead of a book.
In the fall of 1945, my father was honorably discharged from the Navy. He was one of the lucky ones. He'd served on a destroyer escort during the war, first in convoys, dodging U-boats in the Atlantic, and then in the Pacific, where his ship, the USS Schmidt, shot down two kamikaze planes. My dad always kept a framed picture of the Schmidt above his dresser, but like most men of his generation, he didn't talk a lot about his war years. One story he did tell me, because it haunted him, was about a shipmate who was lost on duty one night. That sailor had told the other guys on watch that he was going to the galley to get some cherry pie and coffee. While he was crossing the deck, a wave smashed into the ship and washed him overboard. The captain, against regulations, ordered the ship's lights turned on to search for the sailor in the black waters. That poor guy was never found. Like I said, my dad was one of the lucky ones. And how special he must have felt in late December of 1945 when a letter from Washington, D.C. came for him at his sister's house in Lenox Hills, Pennsylvania. My father was living with his sister and her family because by then both of his parents had died. The letter, signed in fountain pen, was from the Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal. It began, "My dear Mr. Corrigan, I have addressed this letter to reach you after all the formalities of your separation from active service are completed. I have done so because, without formality, but as clearly as I know how to say it, I want the Navy's pride in you, which it is my privilege to express, to reach into your civil life and to remain with you always." I found this letter about a year ago in one of the many boxes of stuff that people leave behind when they die. My dad died in 1997, and I'm still finding stuff. The beauty of the letter's opening paragraph literally took my breath away. This may have been a quote-unquote form letter, but there was a compassionate presence behind those words. Someone, either James Forrestal or an anonymous aide serving under him, had the humanity to think about the hundreds of thousands of sailors who were going to have to adjust to civilian life. Many of them, like my father, had been in the Navy since right after the attack on Pearl Harbor. In that pre-computer age, clerical staff would have had to hunt up all those former sailors' forwarding addresses and mail this letter out to them. The letter goes on to list some of the achievements of the greatest Navy in the world, and it concludes with these words, "For your part in these achievements, you deserve to be proud as long as you live. The nation which you served at a time of crisis will remember you with gratitude. The best wishes of the Navy go with you into civilian life. Good luck." I've tried to find out what I can about this letter. It seems that it was sent, as it should have been, to all discharged sailors. The fountain pen signature on my dad's letter is probably a facsimile of Forrestal's handwriting, made with an auto pen. If you go on eBay, you can see the same vintage letter for sale for as low as $14.99. Also sad is James Forrestal's own post-World War II history. He became the first ever Secretary of Defense under President Truman, but Truman later dismissed him in March of 1949. Suffering from depression, Forrestal committed suicide 2 months later by jumping from a window on the 16th floor of Bethesda Naval Hospital. Many conspiracy theorists still allege that Forrestal was murdered. Here's what I know for certain. I know that when my 25-year-old father received this letter, it meant the world to him. I'll bet that in 1945, most other discharged sailors around the country felt the same way. I've asked a couple of friends who served in Vietnam whether they ever received a letter of gratitude, and they say no. One vet I showed my dad's letter to printed a copy to tape over his desk so that other vets in his office could read it. Almost 7 decades later, that letter conveys something special to ex-service people. I know Memorial Day is about honoring those who've died in service to this country, But the tender grace in that gesture from an earlier age reminds us that gratitude to those who've served and continue to serve doesn't need to be rationed.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can see the letter Maureen's father got from the Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal, on our Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
One of the Smithsonian museums, the Hirshhorn, came up with an ambitious new design. Why not build a giant inflatable structure that would be big enough for both art and for people to walk around in? But as NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, some of the Smithsonian's trustees in Washington, D.C. aren't blown away by the idea.
Some say the windowless Hirshhorn Museum of Contemporary Art on the National Mall looks like a concrete bunker. The building is shaped like a donut. The translucent blue bubble would balloon out of the hole in the middle. The architects are world-renowned. Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro worked on the High Line, New York City's hugely popular public park. In a TED Talk, architect Liz Diller described her vision for the Hirshhorn.
It's basically one big volume of air that just oozes out in every direction. The membrane is translucent. It's made of silicone-coated glass.
The bubble's biggest supporter was Richard Koshalik, the Hirshhorn's director. He was hired by the Smithsonian 5 years ago, in part to shake things up with exciting new ideas. But last week, when the Board of Trustees couldn't come to an agreement on whether to continue fundraising to build the bubble, Koshalik resigned. Richard Curran, the Smithsonian's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture, isn't optimistic about the bubble's future now, even though he thinks it would have been good for the staid National Mall.
I think it would have shown the airiness of our democracy, the flow of things, the fact that we weren't a solid, rock, unmoving type of country. So I could see its symbolic appeal.
Curran says about half of the $15 million it would take to complete the project has already been raised from private sources, but he's doubtful the Smithsonian can raise the rest. And in these days of budget cuts and sequestration, they don't plan on asking Congress to pay for a bubble. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is jazz pianist Keith Jarrett performing Somewhere by Leonard Bernstein. It's the title track of a new album of six standard tunes revisited by Jarrett and his trio, which includes bassist Gary Peacock and drummer Jack DeJohnette. The release of this music has been a couple of years in coming from the time it was performed in Switzerland. Keith Jarrett, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Standard tunes. First of all, what do they mean to you, and why have you recorded so many of them in this disc?
First of all, they're anything but standard by today's standards. They're exceptional. There was a period of time in American history where so many things came rushing in, especially in popular music. The people that were doing that were people who were actually good at writing melodies, for example. And I worked with a lot of vocalists when I was young and listened to them because my father liked Keeley Smith, and I probably heard Peggy Lee in those days, and was impressed by phrasing. Once Miles was asked, how did he learn his phrasing, or who would he listen to for that? And he said, Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, isn't that something? Do we not have more songs like this for lack of people trying to write them? Is it unfashionable?
Yes, is the short answer to that. But I was in Tokyo once, and I thought, I think I want to try to write a song as though it existed before and has words. I sat down and wrote this standard tune, but it wasn't that easy to do. It's called No Lonely Night. It could have words easily. It could be sung by a good singer. But again, let's say that there are also no important singers. So maybe it's all part of the same pancake mix. If there's no singers and there's no good songs, which came first?
I guess in fairness, we should say that for every, just to pick a couple of random favorites of mine, for every September in the Rain or The Nearness of You, there are dozens of utterly unmemorable tunes.
This is true.
As well, yeah.
Yeah, this is definitely true.
This disc was recorded in Switzerland, in Lucerne, in 2009.
Yeah.
Why does such a good recording take almost 4 years to get released?
There's a lot of answers to that, Robert. But sometimes they have to steep. And our experience with this hall was bad. In other words, we didn't like the sound when we were playing. Gary had an awful time with his bass sound in the room. I didn't like the piano at all. Jack agreed that the hall was really not very good. And I had played there before, had the same experience. So it almost was as though sometimes it's like you have to slowly get rid of what you remember from the backstage or the, you know, the Germans not letting my wife sit in her seat because they didn't see her the first set and she has a ticket, and they end up putting her behind the spotlights where she had to stand and sweat.
So for you, for a year or more, this performance brings up all these memories, these very unpleasant memories, of something not working well.
It's very hard to get rid of that right away.
But I listened to it for the first time. I hear none of that.
No, it's not there. We've worked on it, too. I tried not to manipulate anything. I like the raw tapes. I like it just as it's handed to me the night that it happens. I want the imperfections to remain because, to tell the truth, the way I play in a given space is because of the space. So if we start to change that and I listen to it, then I don't even like it at all. Because it's like, why did I didn't play the left hand that loud, or that isn't how the piano sounded. But in this particular case, it was just convincing Gary that it was good.
Gary Peacock.
Yeah. Was a really tough thing because he was in hell that night as far as the sound was concerned.
This didn't sound like a guy unable to play his bass that night.
Now we're getting to the part where we're actually perfectionists.
I see.
We're pretty fussy. And Gary's memory was the only thing he had. So then first I had to send him a copy of the recording. Then I had to ask him what happened, you know, what did he think? And he said, oh, there's no bass on here. And so I said, okay, Gary, can you come down to my house and listen to it on my system? So he came to the house, and after a few minutes, he looked at me and with the kind of look like, okay, what was the big fuss about?
So there was at some point an acceptance of this performance that maybe the recorded sound of it was not as bad as the experiencing of it.
Yeah, plus players are very protective of their turf. Over and over in the past, I've had the experience of knowing we just played the best version of something. We will not need to do another take.
And is that borne out when you then listen to the the tape of it?
Yeah, because if it's a band, it's a band. And, you know, if what we do when we're playing together is good enough, even the solos don't matter that much. What matters is the spirit kept. And I know that's why Gary had to say, okay. Because no matter what he might not like, whatever notes he might not like of his, I've often told him, Gary, I can point to notes too. Somebody once wrote me a letter saying, oh, thank God, you're human. You're not God. You made mistakes on Rio or something like that.
Well, Keith Jarrett, first of all, I'm really glad that you guys got over your negative memories of this night in Lucerne back in July of 2009 and released this disc because it's terrific.
Thank you.
And it's been great fun talking with you.
Thanks, Robert. Nice to talk to you, too.
The album is called Somewhere by Keith Jarrett. Also bassist Gary Peacock and drummer Jack DeJohnette. This is NPR News.
The American West has always been fertile ground for writers. Now Philip Meyer steps into that territory with his new novel, The Sun. It's a family saga that traces the settling of Texas from its days as a wild frontier to the oil boom. And there's no shortage of violence in this version of the story. Even the victims have blood on their hands, as NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Philip Meyer first drew attention a few years ago with his debut novel, American Rust. Set in a dying steel town in Pennsylvania, Meyer says he wanted to explore the decline of the middle class in the industrial Northeast. He set his sights on a different direction for The Sun.
With The Sun, I wanted to do something not quite the opposite, but certainly different. I wanted to think about our creation myth. You know, what is the fundamental story that defines America? And it certainly is the West.
To research the novel, Meyer read more than 250 books on the West. But that wasn't enough for him. To get a sense of what life might have been like for the Comanche, who play a central role in the book, he spent months in the desert and the plains, eating and sleeping outdoors.
I told myself to bow hunt. I took weeks or months of tracking classes on how to track animals and how to understand how Native Americans related to their environment. I went to a buffalo rancher who raises organic grass-fed buffalo for restaurants, and I helped him kill several buffalo. And after we shot these animals, basically, I took a coffee mug and filled it with the blood from the animal's neck and drank it, because that was another thing the Comanches did with some regularity.
The Sun is an epic tale told through several generations of the McCullough family, beginning with Eli McCullough, the first male child born in the Republic of Texas. At the age of 13, Eli is kidnapped by the Comanche, who kill his mother and his siblings. He lives with the Comanche for years, becoming a respected member of the tribe. But later in his life, he hunts them down as a Texas Ranger. He becomes a wealthy cattle rancher, and eventually his land brings more wealth to his family in the form of oil. Throughout it all, if something gets in his way, Eli removes it, with force if necessary.
Eli McCullough represents the sort of mythological heroes that founded America or founded the West. I mean, they're physically powerful. I mean, in this case, he's a small man, but he's physically powerful. They're physically brave. They take what they want. If you were to do some moral analysis of their character, you know, they wouldn't maybe, by today's moral standards, come out looking very good.
We hear one version of the McCullough family story through Eli's own words, but we get a different perspective from his son Peter, who sees his father with clear eyes. Peter's sympathies lie with the Mexican family whose massacre leads to more land for the McCulloughs, and that makes Peter a pariah in his own family. Finally, we hear what seem to be the dying thoughts of Jeannie, Eli's great-granddaughter, who oversees the family's oil business. Jeannie always saw Eli as a heroic figure and was determined to protect his legacy.
What should she tell her grandchildren? There were too many facts, and you could arrange them in any order you wanted. Eli McCullough had killed Indians. Eli McCullough had killed whites. He had killed, period. It depended on whether you saw things through his eyes or the eyes of his victim as he pulled the trigger. Dead people did not have voices, and this made them irrelevant.
But Meyer doesn't paint a black and white picture of the West. If Eli McCullough kills to get what he needs, so does everyone else.
There was an enormous amount of violence perpetuated by all sides. You know, the sort of guilt or horror is very evenly shared. And I think when you grew up watching John Wayne movies, which many of us did, you don't see that. You forget that. You sort of think of the Anglo folks, you know, the cowboys, as the sort of innocents in the middle of a great wilderness out of which ride these Native Americans, who we hadn't thought of as Indians, and attack, you know, the innocent settlers. And this, to me, was crucial to sort of attempt to upend that myth.
And yet, at the same time, you certainly are not presenting a sort of PC picture of life among the Comanches. This was really brutal, and the violence is depicted very graphically.
This is a warrior culture. You know, I mean, they were absolutely warriors. They did not show mercy to the people they vanquished. Torture was something they did, but just torture was something that Europeans engaged in ritualistically also.
Meyer says he doesn't expect that everyone will like his version of how the West was won.
I do wonder if there are parts of this book that are going to make people on both sides of the debate angry. the people who want to see, you know, the sort of historic Texans and the frontiers people as noble sort of innocents, and the people who want to see the Native Americans in that same very simplistic way. But to do this is to reduce these people to caricatures. So if it makes people uncomfortable, I guess I'm fine with it.
No one emerges an innocent in this story, not the Anglos, nor the Mexicans, nor the Native Americans. Each group in its own time fought viciously to get or keep the land. Eli McCullough emerged a winner, but the actions he took and the secrets his family kept will catch up with them in the end. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green.
The across-the-board federal budget cuts known as sequestration are beginning to affect schools in Indian country. For the Navajo Nation, that means larger class sizes and putting off building repairs. And a big deal, where children travel up to 70 miles to get to school, fewer buses. Laurel Morales of member station KJZZ got on board one bus for this report from Flagstaff, Arizona.
Orson Bigman sits behind the wheel of a small school bus. He's the director of transportation for Tuba City Schools. He drives over what looks like an off-road trail for weekend warriors.
All right, here we go. Usually I tell my drivers, take a little bit of a run at it. If you have to, slam it down.
Oh, my gosh.
You can't go over the sand dune.
This is a school route.
This is a school route.
Bigman says he drives 6 miles over sand dunes and rocks to get to two students' bus stop. And on rainy days, he may not get to them at all because the road is washed out. All of his drivers complain of back problems.
As you can see, I try to keep my body as stiff as I can, kind of move along with the bumps. And don't get to a point where you're really hitting a bump hard, getting a shock to your body.
And you can imagine what those bumps do to the buses, literally shaking the screws loose. Bigman says a bus that should last the district 10 years lasts 5, and they don't know if they will have the money to buy a new one next year. School Superintendent Harold Begay would like to take a few members of Congress on this bus ride.
The powers that be, lawmakers and so on, they don't see this. You know, they've never been out here.
Sequestration has already meant the loss of $60 million in federal impact aid for schools that serve American Indian children across the country. And administrators like Begay are anticipating more cuts next year. Begay walks me past the Tuba City High School gym, where sun shines through the holes in the ceiling. At the nearby primary school, one wing and a cafeteria have already been condemned. That building is in desperate need of new bathrooms and safe playground equipment, but those upgrades will have to wait. On the playground, Principal Charlene Navajo watches the students enjoy their field day. A teacher yells instructions through a bullhorn as students try to pass eggs to each other on paper plates. Navajo says the school has 7 open positions due to attrition, but sequestration means she will have to leave those vacant.
There's going to be more responsibility placed on our teachers. But I can see that I have a staff that's going to not let that be the determining factor for our students.
Teachers say in addition to larger classes, they will have to buy scissors, crayons, and other supplies themselves. Superintendent Begay says all this has a big effect on teachers' attitudes.
A scale of 1 to 10, you're constantly at the lower end, you know, 3, 4, 5. When you have a unreliable revenue flow, always being underfunded, to say that it hurts morale is putting it mildly.
But Begay and a lot of people in the Navajo Nation say they're used to doing more with less. It seems to be a reservation motto.
We almost have to develop a pathological immunity to, you know, any kind of government funding, especially federal funding.
70% of his students graduate, but Begay says many of them are not prepared to compete in the outside world. He's working hard to change not just teachers, but the whole community's low expectations. But that's especially hard to do with less federal funding. Begay says one of the most important things they can teach children is resiliency, something people living in Indian country have to learn the hard way. For NPR News, I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
This story comes to us as part of the journalism collaboration Fronteras, the Changing America Desk. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News.
We've asked you to send us stories about the vintage sounds of technology you miss, and we've been listening to those stories on All Things Considered. Today, Scott Smith of Duncan, South Carolina, with the help of his own vintage sound collection, tells us about something he recalls first hearing when he was a small child.
I can remember I fell in love with the startup sound of an electromechanical pinball machine, when I was 3 or 4 years old. We're with family in my grandparents' hometown of Lancaster, South Carolina, and we walked into a department store there, and there stood this big wooden box. There was a man standing there playing it, of course. So I cried a little bit and finally convinced my dad to put me up into a grocery buggy where I could stand and watch, and I was mesmerized. Over the years, that love grew, and every summer when we'd take our vacations up to the mountains of North Carolina, there was a little arcade right near the house where we stayed, and I would beg for quarters and play pinball and play pinball and play pinball and got pretty good at it. I can remember one day going to church. We sat down front for the children's sermon, and the pastor was trying to get us to understand the value of money and putting that money, when we earn it, into the offering plate on Sunday. So he came along and asked us, what would we do with a quarter? And so other people said various things, and he got to little Scott, and little Scott said, I would play a game of pinball.
Listener and no longer little Scott Smith of Duncan, South Carolina. Those sounds come from his collection of old pinball machines that he loved as a child.